This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Count Fosco. Count, I just watched the film Cruel Intentions again. What have you been up to?
Oh, I've been looking up some of the old stuff, some of the past versions of it I've been downloading. But yeah, I saw it again, and I think I first saw this in high school. And it was, I don't know if it's been played more than its value, but I mean, I thought it was an intriguing kind of movie for someone who didn't really, you know, understand the whole cruelty angle in relationships, or really understood it at all at that age. I guess it was a little bit out of place, but I mean, looking back, there's a lot of things in it that really make you think about how people see sex today.
Yeah, I've probably seen it about several times over a long period of time. I think, like you, I first saw it when I was in high school.
One thing that I think was interesting, I mean, like, a lot of the themes in it, they don't really, I don't think it really has an ending that makes a whole lot of sense to me. I mean, when you look at the original Le Dangerous, Les Liaisons Dangereuses. I'm not saying that right. It's
so that's
French.
That's the French film that was based upon.
Well, yeah, the French film, and also a original novella previously, and
so this came
it
out.
Really,
the original novella was written right after the French Revolution.
Yeah. It was in the 1700s.
Also, and, before the French Revolution.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, like, the characters are very loosely based on it, and, like, the Japanese version is even more loosely based. I haven't seen the Japanese version yet, but I think the Japanese version actually got something right just from reading the plot. Because if you notice in the movie, it's just kind of like, I don't want to say a deus ex machina, but Valmont just, you know, has this moment where he's in love, but I don't really think they built that up. Like, there's no real explanation why a serial seducer should suddenly fall in love with one, you know, pure girl.
So you're talking about the character that Sebastian is based upon?
Yeah, Sebastian, the Count of Valmont. And in the Japanese version, it's strongly implied that there are real consequences for him, and he doesn't just kind of walk away as this redeemed character. But in this movie, it's just kind of left to us to think of him as someone who's been redeemed by love, which doesn't really make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, because in the film, that's the narrative of the film, that he's been this sociopathic individual, and he's redeemed by his sacrifice. But I think it's a very simplistic narrative. He's still pretty much a lousy individual, and he just... So it is. I agree with you that it's kind of cheesy.
Something else, though, that I actually liked. The beginning of the movie has a lot of it has foreshadowing in it. I mean, I think my favorite part of the movie is just him driving on the road. That is my favorite part. Especially because at the very beginning, you'll notice he's actually driving past a graveyard.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. And he's driving a 1956 Jaguar XK-140 Roadster.
Right. But he's driving over a graveyard. And, you know, you can read into that symbolically. I mean, I didn't really read into it symbolically until, like, I saw it again. And I'm like, oh, yeah, well, you know, this is about his end, really.
So that's kind of the key question is, it's kind of the ending of the film, but we're talking about at the beginning is, like, whether he is redeemed or not. And yeah. Your point was that you don't think it's realistic for him to fall in love being the kind of person he is, or you don't think that his actions redeem himself?
I don't think there's enough development, and that's why I would give the movie a kind of a low rating, I guess. But I think they need to really explain why he would change his character so radically. It just seems like they wrote it and they couldn't have him be a bad character, but he obviously is. Like, they don't allow for the same sort of redemption for Catherine, which is interesting. Like, she's this evil, manipulative person, like a mirror image of him, which was the interesting thing about the beginning of their relationship, because they're both mirror images of each other. They're even brother and sister in an adopted sense.
So the main theme of the movie is the corruption of innocence or purity.
I see it that way. I mean, like, you have these two really demonic people, Sebastian and Catherine, and their whole deal is to corrupt the one virgin at their high school, which, you know, they both are completely in on it, and their bargain is sexual in itself. Like, she's going to get his car if he loses, and he's going to get her, he's going to get to put it anywhere if he wins. So even, like, they really are mirror images of each other, even if you think of the Jaguar Roadster as a, you know, a giant penis.
Could you see those characters in the Journey to Vapor Island?
I actually think they would be great in the world of a Journey to Vapor Island. Especially if the idea would be to corrupt anything that's still good about Gnome. If we had two characters that got together to destroy Gnome in that way, that would definitely fit.
Would you say that there's comparisons to any of the characters, like the Chads, or there's Nick, and then there's the character Wendy Silverstein and her friends?
The character that I thought was most interesting in terms of Chadhood, putting aside the gay couple, who were very Chad-like, the character Court Reynolds, who originally kicks off Catherine's anger, I thought it was interesting that, of course, he was described as a Nazi.
Oh, right.
Like, I thought that was just too perfect. In fact, I think even in the flashback scene, he even was wearing, like, was he wearing a polo shirt?
I think so.
He, he is the white rich boy image, and of course he's depicted as this, you know, hot Nazi who she worked very hard to please, but who dumped her and described her as a bulimic head case.
Oh, and then he dumps her for Cecile.
For Cecile, yeah. What's the name of the gay guy who he goes to get his information from?
I forget his name, but I know who you're talking about.
There's this blonde gay guy. I'm drawing a blank, but I would compare Nick more to him. Definitely you'd have to kind of explain why he's so easily cowed by Sebastian. I mean, he doesn't have to help Sebastian for money. So in your book, you'd have to kind of up the ante for why Nick should do things. Because they're all pretty much rich. They don't need to rat each other out for like $100.
And what about the character Wendy Silverstein?
Wendy Silverstein. I would compare her to like Sarah Michelle Gellar or her evil character, Catherine. I could picture her playing her.
Oh yeah, for sure. Remember what she does at the kind of party she organizes?
That would be interesting. Like a secret society. You could have a party.
Oh, Cecile is like, oh yeah, like a secret society.
Right. of course, that was meant as a joke, but if you wanted to make it real, yeah.
When I was on Netflix, I noticed under suggested films, the film that shows up is Eyes Wide Shut.
That might be a coincidence. Might be a dirty coincidence.
What do you think about that scene when Sebastian first seduces Cecile, and they, I think they have cunnilingus, but she describes it as, she was talking to Catherine, and she's like, well, she wrote letters on me with my tongue, and then it was like icky at first, but then it kind of felt good, and then
I can't really imagine that happening. I mean, I've been on dates with girls, and I think if I did that, I think I'd be stopped pretty fast. Yeah. I think she was like, Cecile has to be one very gullible character in real life for that to even work. Or she'd have to be a party to it.
Yeah, she's almost kind of like a caricature. Like, she's like totally... Yeah. She's so gullible, she's almost unrealistic.
Right. It's like she's the easy version of what he wants to do. But, in fact, it's kind of ironic that the girl who was the easy version is, in fact, the reason he ended up dead.
What do you think about Sarah Michelle Gellar with dark hair? She's usually a blonde.
Yeah, she has that image from being a blonde from movies like Scooby-Doo and of course Buffy and that sort of thing. I think she comes across as much more typically Jewish as a brunette. As a blonde, she could be pretty much anything with that look, but she has a kind of very mousy face, so the minute you make her a brunette, like, I instantly think, okay, she's clearly Jewish. But with the blonde, it's a lot harder to see that. I think it's interesting how very similar Sarah Michelle Gellar looks to the Israeli nationalist politician Eilat Shakid. I don't know if I'm saying her name right.
Oh, yeah. I know who you're talking about. She's known as being kind of a hardliner.
Right.
And
right,
I think on Luke Ford's feed, one of Luke's friends, I think it may have been Haima Moloch, but I forget who it was joking about her being like a dominatrix.
I didn't see that. I don't know if it's true, but I mean, I'm just remarking on like the physical similarity. They look exactly the same.
Would you put her up there with like Alicia Silverstone and the other actresses we were discussing?
I used to think Sarah Michelle Gellar was attractive, yeah. I think Alicia is much more attractive, though. But sure, yeah, she's she'd be in the Israeli Aryan pantheon. This movie had the lion's share. It had two.
It seems that most of those actresses were big in the 90s. Like there was this big,
yeah,
there was this big phase in the 90s for some reason.
It's possible that they had like more real self-empowered women in the 90s who all tend to be Jewish, but now we don't really have that. We have more propped up women and women being exposed as sleeping to the top. So I don't know if Trump has really brought the 90s back, but I don't know. We'll see. A lot of people think he has.
What do you think about the whole theme of entrapment involving both the gay entrapment, but that's a big theme in general, the theme of entrapment and blackmail?
Yeah. I mean, the idea is to... I mean, they talk about blackmail several times throughout the show. There's the gay entrapment, of course, with the football stud. Then there's also just embarrassing Cecile's family from the very beginning. And then at the very end, of course, Catherine threatens to expose Sebastian to the headmaster.
Was that by publishing his manifesto?
Right, exactly. And of course, all through it, you know, there's a subtext that, you know, their parents are away and both engaged in their degenerate practices on their own. So it's almost like you can't really entrap them as each other, but when it comes to society as a whole, you can. There's also the whole mixed race angle with Cecile's mother being a kind of...
Oh, right, Christine Baranski.
Yeah, kind of. She's a kind of boomer conservative, meaning in public.
Oh, she's like, race. I'm not racist. I gave money to Colin Powell.
Yeah, exactly. That scene, which I think it really, really summarizes the boomer generation. Like, if Cecile married her music teacher, they wouldn't say anything. But at the same time, I think on some subconscious level, even though they're too cowardly to say anything, a bare 50% of them would have some kind of problem. But at the same time, they're totally hypocritical about it. Like, they don't really have any identity aside from just being white and giving money to Colin Powell.
And with that whole issue, it's amazing how the attitudes has changed, because I've seen polls as recently as the 1980s, maybe 50 to 60 people were opposed to interracial relationships. So that's a pretty remarkable change in a recent time, and you've seen the same trend with gay marriage.
It's probably even lower than that. I mean, people are very intimidated to have the correct opinion on the subject, and I have to wonder to what degree these movies are an expression of that, or if they are in fact the result of that. I don't know which is which, the chicken or the egg. But I think a lot of things in this movie really, I mean, they're stereotypical, but they nail the stereotype right on. Like, I can't think of anybody in my personal life offhand who would really be like Mrs. Caldwell. But, you know, I can totally picture that. I think we're at a point now where people won't give money to Colin Powell, but at the same time, they won't say anything about their black music teacher. I think that's the kind of more the stereotype now.
That the black music teacher is portrayed in a much more positive light than the other characters like Sebastian and Catherine.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. I mean, like, he's not a really grasping, nasty guy himself. He seems to be almost a complete innocent.
He's more of a romantic. He's not like your stereotype of a black man.
No, he's not like the ghetto thug. He's presented as a completely romantic, nice guy. So a kind of a 1% of a 1% put in a perfect light. And it's really Catherine that pushes them together.
And then there's that scene where Sebastian walks to Catherine's room and he hears her moaning. And then...
Right.
She has him not naked, but in his underwear with a feather, and she's tucked, and he's in a closet under her bed. And obviously, a lot of right wingers would view that scene as degenerate, but in some ways, it's like he's kind of like a slave in some ways, and it's like a dominatrix theme.
I think that would be an interesting way to see it. Like, he has no real value aside from what he can do to serve her.
What do you picture happening? Do you picture it being on par with what happened to Justin to Wendy Silverstein at the party on Journey to Vapor Island?
My mind didn't even go there. I thought they were just having cupcakes and tea, and they were just, you know, pretending to play with the feather just to get Sebastian's goat. My mind did not go there, I swear.
I noticed that my mind's become a lot dirtier after writing that novel.
Yes. That might be possible. It might have that effect. I don't know. I don't know what you can do with a feather. It's not really in my repertoire yet.
What do you think about Catherine's general attitude towards sex?
I think she's, well, I mean, there are some feminists who will see her little speech about the male-female double standard as spot on and inspiring. I don't know if I've really met a woman who's quite that direct. I've met women who justify what they do in all kinds of weird, compassionate ways that really damage themselves, but I've never really met anybody like Catherine. I don't really know how to picture Catherine. I think she's definitely on the spectrum of sociopathy.
Both Sebastian and Catherine are obviously on that spectrum.
Yeah, in different ways. I think he's more of a big baby, and I think for some reason she actually comes across as having more agency than he does.
Yeah, definitely. We touched on this theme in the Eyes Wide Shut show, but there is this theme of upper class degeneracy.
Yeah. The thing that I think is interesting about sex when you're rich versus sex when you're either working class or more of a lump and prole type is, when it's presented in books or movies, usually it doesn't come across as bad. I mean, of course, you know, I have to disavow, but if Catherine and Sebastian were like trailer trash, and you made this story with them, they would probably be arrested at the end of the story.
Yeah, for sure.
Like they would be arrested as a grooming gang almost. But because they're wealthy and they live on Long Island,
they live in the Upper East Side, and then there's that palatial estate, which I think is Sebastian's aunt. But obviously, I mean, to live in New York City, multimillionaires are living in modest condos. To have a kind of place like they live in, they're probably billionaires.
No, at least. I mean, like, Orizont must be part of some kind of foundation or something to afford that.
More like a British manor house.
I actually looked it up. It was in a bunch of other movies as well from the 70s, that manor house, or that residence. And, it's pretty impressive.
But is it in England or somewhere on the East Coast?
It's on the East Coast. It's just outside of New York.
I forgot to bring this up on the Eyes Wide Shut show, but the manor house that they use for Eyes Wide Shut was actually built by the Rothschilds, which goes back to the whole conspiracy theory angle.
That's interesting. Of course, the Rothschilds aren't the only big banking family out there, but it's interesting that they're always invoked with this sort of thing.
I mean, I haven't been to the East Coast, so the East Coast is more influenced by England, but in California, most of the big mansions are more of a, like, Mediterranean or Spanish aesthetic.
Built by the Spanish. Yeah, I just looked it up because I'm really curious. The location of the estate is in New York. It's in New York, and it's called the Old Westbury Gardens, and it was built by the British. It's a Charles II style mansion, and it's been featured in a number of different films, including North by Northwest and the Manchurian Candidate. And it also served as the inspiration for the estate in the 2013 version of The Great Gatsby.
Yeah, I haven't seen that film, but that makes sense.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, probably somewhere there's that famous place, the Gold Coast of Long Island.
It's a beautiful place.
Have you been there?
Nope. I still want to take a trip to the States. I still have not done that.
I have been to England, so I've been to some of the manor houses, but nothing that spectacular. With Sebastian, I guess he's a little bit more flamboyant than the usual pickup artist. He's confident, but there's something unnatural or artificial about him.
I don't know if I really thought of it that way. I mean, the way in which he's always grabbing women by the hand, that is something that pickup artists will advise. It's part of their Kino escalation strategy. I don't really know much about it. But he initiates contact with his victims very early on. If you remember at the very beginning, when he gets back at his therapist by sleeping with her daughter.
Tara Reid, and then there was that scene where he immediately picks up that attractive girl in the lobby.
He does that a number of times throughout the show. He at the very beginning, he grabs her hand, he directs her where he wants her. When they visit his aunt, he does the same thing. He does the same thing with Cecile a couple of times. So he definitely is very confident. I don't know if I would say it's artificial. I think his femininity is artificial. He seems a little bit too flamboyant for what he's doing, but at the same time, I guess he's rich.
So, oh, are you saying that he's kind of a pretty boy?
I think he is a little bit of a pretty boy, yeah. If I was rich tomorrow, I don't think I would be quite that flamboyant. I think maybe it's just a class thing that I don't know anything about.
Or it could have been also more of an 80s to 90s thing. Maybe the culture has become more chattish.
Maybe. Certainly the alt-right has become very chattish. I didn't really see that when, like, listening to guests on your previous shows. A lot of intellectual types don't really come across that way, but today, politics have really shifted, and there's much more of, I don't want to say high energy, but you get a lot more of that now.
Between Catherine, yeah. Cecile, and the other character, which girl do you find the most attractive?
Oh, that is really hard to say. I don't know. I don't think any of them are raving beauties. I really can't comment. I don't think any of them are really that attractive. But
really?
No, not really. Probably I'd say Sarah Michelle Gellar, but that's more just because she's very aggressive.
Yeah, I would agree. So you would still find like the film The Crush much more so?
The film The Crush, not only was she aggressive, but she was oddly attractive.
Much more, much more so.
Yeah, like if she played the character that if she played the character that I'm drawing a blank on her name now. Legally Blonde
Catherine?
Character. Why aren't we thinking of
her? I know the actress. Yeah, I forget her name too. Like
Legally Blonde. She plays in Legally Blonde, and everyone knows her from that. Okay, I got it. Reese Witherspoon.
Right.
If she was as an innocent, if she played Sarah Michelle Gellar's character, it would be more like The Crush. I think she did Innocent very well, and that was her strong point.
Well, in The Crush, she combines the cute innocence with the kind of psychopathic side. With Catherine is gorgeous, but she's also has more of a kind of hard look to her.
Yeah, like she could be running a bordello, and we would be completely convinced. But with Alicia Silverstone, we could not really think of that. That would just be a horror story. And definitely, I would say that The Crush is a better movie than Cruel Intentions. But Cruel Intentions is more for, a less sophisticated audience.
Yeah.
Cruel
Intentions was a Hollywood blockbuster. The Crush is one of my favorite movies, but it's more of a niche. It didn't become a Hollywood blockbuster.
It's a psychological thriller, and just personally, I like the psychological thrillers because you don't really expect what's going to happen. While with a lot of these kind of these, what do you call them? Like, I don't know how I would describe The Crush. It's like a teen film. It's similar to I Know What You Did Last Summer, but without the violence. So it's not really my kind of movie, but I see why they would push it on high school children as kind of a sexy movie, but it doesn't really shock me that much.
Do you think with Catherine versus Reese Witherspoon's character, they kind of play on the Jewish versus WASP theme?
That is the interesting thing about this. I mean, I'm surprised no one's ever looked at this movie and said, this is an anti-Semitic trope.
Oh, because there's that famous scene in the end where she's in the church and she opens up the cross and she snorts coke.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is the sort of movie that Alex Linder would write if he wanted to portray Jews as these evil, manipulative, corruptive, ethnocentric people. This movie actually completely says that. That is Catherine's character. She's the one Jewish girl at a presumably all-Christian upper-class school, and of course she's snorting coke out of a cross and corrupting all the Gentile girls. This movie could be made by the Daily Stormer. Like the situation here is exactly what they would tell us to expect. So, I mean, it's not my sort of movie, and I wouldn't necessarily see this, I guess, subconscious subtext play out, but that's the subtext. Not only is the subtext, you know, the hypocritical Christian girl, but the subtext is, you know, we Israeli Aryan conspirators clearly control everybody, and everybody is under our thumb.
Another thing that
is the subtext.
That you pointed out is Catherine, she has a Vietnamese servant, but most of the people she surrounds herself with are basically pretty much all white.
Yeah, that I think is just symbolic of like the hypocrisy of the upper class, which, you know, I think is spot on. Like, they don't mind having poorly paid, essentially, you know, almost slave labor, but not really. While at the same time, the places they like to socialize in will be more white. I think it's another trope that is really spot on. It's hypocrisy, and it's something we see very often.
And yeah, there is. That's definitely true, but even though people say that Hollywood, a lot of conspiracy theorists and dissidents say Hollywood is controlled opposition and all that, or it's controlled media, but a lot of this stuff does get exposed in film.
Yeah, that's part of the reason why I don't think it's controlled. If it was controlled, you would see stuff like this basically edited out, and it would be even more convincing that she's just this really hypocritical WASP girl corrupting all the other little nymphites. But we don't see that. So I don't really see Hollywood as under some kind of mysterious control. I think a lot of people who are anti-Semitic, I think they're really projecting their own, I guess, weakness at infiltrating any kind of society. It's more down to their own I guess, clumsiness. I mean, if someone like Mel Gibson could make it in Hollywood for as long as he did and still make millions, it's not controlled.
I guess before we move on to other topics, is there anything else of significance you'd like to bring up about the film?
Well, I think it's interesting how a lot of the stuff that we would call homophobic today is pretty much taken for granted in the film. Like, we see all kinds of slurs that today people would get very offended at, like fudge packer and queer. Definitely these things would be edited out of a lot of scripts you would submit today, unless it was to depict Valmont as completely unsalvageable. So I think that's something about the 90s, or when this film was made, 1999, that sort of language was pretty much allowed.
Also, it's very honest. This film, which came out in the late 90s, depicts, it's pretty honest that they're saying that the characters are degenerate, immoral characters, even though there's a theme of Sebastian being redeemed. If you look at a series like Girls on HBO, which also is about privileged young people in New York, the characters, a lot of them are degenerate. But they try to show them as being basically morally good people. I think there is more of an honesty in 80s and 90s cinema that's been lost today?
I haven't actually watched Girls, but isn't it produced by that woman we all love to hate?
Yeah.
Lena Dunham. Lena Dunham, that's her name. I would agree with you that there is kind of an assumption of certain things being inherently wrong in Cruel Intentions, which is why it's dirty and sexy to begin with. While in Girls, there's no real... I haven't seen it, but it just seems, from what you're saying, if we don't have that sexy scene where one character is like, ooh, this is so wrong, we need to stop right now. No, 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 yes, yes, yes. If we don't have that, it's going to be a very boring show. So I just from what you're saying, I think Girls is probably a boring show, but I haven't seen it.
So I guess we can move on to politics. Do you want to talk about all this drama that's going on in the alt-right?
I'm glad that, I'm really not a part of it, and I don't have anything to do with that, so I'm thankful about that. But you're referring to the TWP drama.
So you don't even identify even as alt-right at all?
I would say that I'm just a social nationalist. But as far as the whole American type scene, I mean, I want to be sympathetic to working class people, but at the same time, I think their whole look is just repulsive and isn't going to attract anyone, much less Americans. I think their whole attempt to provide security for alt-right ideas was a good thing, so I don't want to talk down to them for that. But I think the whole militarist aesthetics, plus with the Nazi salutes, maybe that makes low-class people feel powerful, but I have to condemn that as just bad, bad self-presentation.
Yeah, I totally agree. As far as social nationalism, are you closer to the more traditionalist wing, or are you closer to the sort of left wing of the alt-right, like sites like Brandon Adamson's altleft.com?
I've been reading Brandon Adamson's site. There are some things he says I agree with and some things I don't really agree with. I think it's difficult to totally separate left-wing social nationalism from tradition entirely. I mean, even when you see communist movements like the North Koreans, it's interesting that in addition to the hammer and sickle, they will include the brush of Confucius or the Confucian scholars' brush in their symbology.
Yeah, in some ways, tradition... North Korea is closer to fascism than communism. They're hyper-nationalistic. They have a monarchy. They have this weird esoteric religion. It's a very, very, very extreme right-wing version of communism.
It's almost unintentionally fascist. In fact, some people have argued that North Korea is a lot closer to fascism, despite the fact that they were supported by China for as long as they have been. But I guess in ways that, in as far as Americans would see me, they would see me as on the left. As far as, I guess, the mainstream left, they would see me as on the far right.
Basically a hybrid between the European New Right and the alt-left?
I think it's impossible to ignore the New Right. Even the left of the alt-right is really criticizing some ideas on the New Right. In terms of tradition, it's hard to totally ignore that, because you'll notice that even people in the United States will ascribe to some sort of tradition, whether or not they understand it very well or not. So that will always be a basis of their thinking.
So that's your main disagreement with Brandon Adamson's alt-left, is to sort of
I don't think it's possible to separate tradition from nationalist movements, because then all you really have is economic nationalism, and you have an appeal to race, which isn't going to be enough.
Are you a social conservative?
I would say on most things I'm a social conservative, yeah. I'm effectively a social conservative, though not a religious conservative.
But I enjoy degenerate entertainment.
I watch degenerate entertainment, yes. I watch Californication.
Yeah, we all do. Californication, all that stuff.
I watch all the degenerate entertainment, but I don't want my life to end up like that. So,
to end up like Charlie Runkle stuck in the crutches of Sue Kalini?
That would be okay, but it wouldn't be like my ideal. Yeah, it's better than ending up like Elliot Rodger. I think even poor little Charlie Runkle with his tube steak is in a better place than Elliot Rodger.
Yeah, back to Cruel Intentions. Cruel Intentions is kind of how Elliot Rodger would imagine that the rich, popular crowd would live.
That's kind of what he thinks, but in reality, it's probably going to be a little bit harder to pin down.
Yeah, but you'll notice now all the rich trust fund kids pretend to be hipsters and live in, like, Williamsburg.
You know, I've only known one trust fund kid, and he was constantly telling me about how he had to do community service, and that's what he's complaining about. Kind of like Sebastian visiting Mrs. Sugarman.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
So I don't really know that many trust fund kids, but, If you tell me that they are even less inclined to do works of charity, I probably believe you.
With the alt-right, would you say there is a serious class divide with National Policy Institute, Richard Spencer, Amarin being more upper middle class, the right stuff being maybe middle class, and traditional Workers' Party being very pro?
Well, I think the big problem with having these class divides is nobody really feels like people in the alt-right, they use code words a lot mutually, and they use, euphemisms like movement and so on. But when you're on the outside looking in, and you notice these class divisions, you notice that not only is it ideologically incoherent, but some people have a lot less skin in the game than others. And it's very easy to, I guess, laugh at a dumb person who gets fired from her job or his job.
One person, she was whining and complaining that because her Twitter account was named Goebbels. And, I mean, I don't support censorship, but at the same time, I mean, come on, like, you're going around with explicit Nazi imagery is not a smart thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I take it for granted that there's going to be a difference in IQ between different people and different groups. But at the same time, I think we need to acknowledge that if the people who are better off don't have even more skin in the game than the people who aren't so well off, that's not a coherent movement. That's not class collaboration. If you notice, when people can notice the difference between, you know, someone like Richard Spencer playing the role of the evil Anglo-Saxon elite dressed in tweed, while someone like Heimbach dresses in uh, in uh, in a more uniformed fashion. People don't really feel that they're both pulling the same kind of weight. And that's not to say that I want Richard Spencer to dress up in a Nazi uniform. I don't want him to do that. But if he did, that would be a definite signal of, I guess, equality between people.
Yeah, I know Oswald Mosley, who was an aristocrat, he would dress in the same uniform as his working class followers to show a sign of solidarity.
And that was a very European thing. I mean, the communists did that prior to the fascists doing that. And I am against any kind of military dress-up. I think it's stupid. But at the same time, if you want to have some kind of real alt-right movement, you need to have some kind of at least symbolic collaboration with people who are your class inferiors. And without that, you're just not going to have collaboration.
So you would
it's just not going to work.
You would say you're basically an economic populist, but a cultural elitist? In the sense of having high standards?
That would be a good way to put it. I mean, when it comes to culture, I identify with the old upper class. When it comes to economics, I'm right down there with the socialists and the populists. Yeah, that's a good way to describe me.
So, did you see Luke Ford's bit called Alt-Right Anonymous?
I did. I thought it was very funny. I don't have it up right now, but I thought that was hilarious.
Would you say his sense of humor, it's more of a British style?
I think his sense of humor is very deadpan. It's definitely not Seinfeld type humor. It is more what I would call English humor.
Yeah, I know he tries to kind of copy the Jewish mannerisms, but despite that, he's still very... His style is very British or Australian.
Yeah, I don't see a Jewish style in his humor at all. His humor is completely backhanded insults, backhanded compliments. I think a lot of his titles are very hilarious.
Did you see the one Matthew Heimbach did nothing wrong?
Oh yeah, like he's brilliant with these little quips. I actually think he's a lot funnier than Ramsey Paul, who's the comedian of the alt-right. I actually think Luke is a much better comedian. He makes much more interesting commentary, and he's really plugged into the whole meme culture.
Yeah, he directed a porno back in 95, but he didn't act in it. He was just directed it, so the actors were screwing, and he was totally clothed, and he was going around interviewing them. But he admits it's not something he's proud of.
It's interesting that he keeps saying he's not proud of this sort of thing. I mean, I understand. I think he's a very smart guy, and I get a lot out of watching his feeds. But I have to wonder how Orthodox Jews would really see that. I mean, like he said in other feeds that he feels he's like the lowest guy in the synagogue. I'm probably misquoting him, but. I think it's interesting that he would take a very competitive religious atmosphere to be his own, a very difficult religion to join. I think it's interesting that he would choose that.
What do you think about the whole Nathan Koffness critique of Kevin McDonald that Luke Ford has been talking about a lot lately?
I've read the critique. I have not read all three of Kevin McDonald's books. But I'd say the critique is very close to what I thought all along. I basically, when I read a lot of I would describe, I would divide anti-Semitic views into two groups. One would be the sincere intellectual type, and that would be Kevin MacDonald, where he puts forward a thesis, which is probably the best thesis that's been put forward. And then there are the pre-MacDonald types and the imitators of MacDonald. So if you look at websites like Occidental Observer, a lot of the people who publish to that, not including MacDonald, but some of the lesser known writers, they really imitate him. And I think the minute they start imitating him and putting their own spin on it, it really exposes the kind of pseudoscientific, I want to say it's a pseudoscientific point of view. And I don't want to say that just because, I'm this Shabbos goy who's afraid of the Jews. That's not why I'm saying this.
Or you just stir too into IAs. That clouds your...
Or I'm just too into Israeli Aryan women. That could be another thing to accuse me of. But the reason why I'm saying this is because the whole idea of evolutionary psychology by itself, I think, is suspect.
Well, there's this concept of an anti-Semitic canard that Jews are less loyal to their host countries, but I don't think that's a unique characteristic. I just think that's a characteristic of diasporas. I would probably say that Hindus, for example, Hindus living in Canada are probably less loyal to Canada than or French Canadians.
Right, and I've seen that myself. That's absolutely true. It's also true that they are more loyal to their co-ethnics in Canada than to other Indians back in India. So there's also an economic angle there as well. After a while, they become pretty much like I'm drawing a blank, but they kind of meld into a kind of a brown power co-ethnic, which is something very without any traditions, but it's still identifiable.
And I would even say with Europeans living in South Africa, I wouldn't expect them to be loyal to the majority black-dominated ANC-ruled South Africa.
Right. I mean, like, if I was in the ANC, I would of course accuse the white South Africans of being less loyal. I would be right there with Julius Malema saying the whites must be less loyal, despite evidence to the contrary. Clearly, if someone wanted to bring up evidence to the contrary, there would be lots of it. The huge economic benefit of having whites in South Africa would be obvious. But if all you've got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. I take your point.
Since we're on the topic of South Africa, what are your thoughts on that Lawrence Southern documentary?
Well, I haven't seen it yet, but...
I don't think it's officially out. There's just clips of it on YouTube.
Yeah. I mean, it's one thing to make a documentary, but one thing that I'm kind of, black-pilled about is, will this even be shown to kids in high school?
No, of course not. Online will see it.
A lot of people online will see it.
About Lauren Southern is she's kind of alt-right, but she also has a following among a segment of like more normie conservatives, or at least the kind of Breitbart crowd.
She's acceptable. She's more acceptable with normies. It's amazing how presentation does that. The thing that I was getting at, though, with her documentary Farmlands, it could be very effective if we had I guess, the long march through the institutions already in place, and we had people willing to show it in high schools, it would be devastating if that were the case. I would compare it to, like, we have so many documentaries out, and I'm not just thinking about, like, Michael Moore's Bowling for Columbine or Michael Moore's this and that, but even just documentaries on the sufferings of migrants as they try to cross the Mediterranean or as they come into different islands off the coast of Australia. I mean, I have kids I know who watch these documentaries, and their minds are shaped by a lot of these things that are shown to them in high school and grade school.
I heard there was actually a case where a white South African family came to Canada, and they were denied refugee status.
Right, because, they don't want to... They don't want to ruin their relations with the South African government over, you know, I guess, maltreatment of citizens in what I guess could be considered a first world country, which South Africa is.
And I don't think that country can be salvaged. I know there's that community, Orania, but it's basically a gated community. It's very vulnerable. I think that country... either it will stagnate and gradually get worse, or it'll collapse and end up like Zimbabwe. I think the only solution is to give Europeans like the right of return to United States or Europe, the same way that Israel does with Jews living overseas.
Well, I don't know if that's going to happen, but that would be an interesting solution.
I don't even think Trump would touch that. I mean, ideally... I know some Australian politician proposed that as pretty prominent, but I couldn't really see Trump doing that.
Probably not.
And I know with Trump, he's proposing this merit-based immigration system modeled after Canada, but the left is saying Trump's immigration proposal is like a white supremacist proposal. But if you look at Canada's system, which Trump is emulating, it's far from white, is pretty much as far from white nationalism as you can get.
Yeah, we really need to give credit to Stephen Miller for drawing attention to America's immigration system. I think it's called chain migration.
Does Canada have that?
I don't think so. I don't think we have that. I could be wrong. I know that despite that, we do have, we are slated to receive many millions of immigrants over the next decade. So,
because I was reading statistics, Canada is still significantly more European than America, but Europeans are expected to become a minority around the same time. So Canada is actually changing demographically at a much more rapid pace.
I feel it is, but that's just my own anecdotal suspicion that we're moving at a more rapid pace. We just elect the immigrants better.
Back to the Nathan Koffness critique of Kevin MacDonald, what do you see as the role of Jewish intellectuals in the alt-right or in dissident politics?
Well, when you read a lot of the, the alt-right commentary, it is very anti-Semitic. I mean, it is very anti-Jewish, obviously. But, even if you listen to past broadcasts with their notables, they will always complain about any Jewish intellectual that shows up to speak at Amran, for example. I don't see that as a problem. If anything, I see that as a good thing, because from the point of view of a completely unacceptable movement, the very fact you have anybody talking to you at all should be seen as a positive.
Because there's whack job conspiracy theorists who say, oh, the Jews are coming in to subvert the alt-right. But the thing is, those individuals are taking a big risk to their own social and economic status by joining such a fringe movement that's vilified.
That is true, but I would make an even more damning point, and that is that even if these Jewish intellectuals come in to subvert, honestly, I'm okay with that. And here's why. Because you don't have any power whatsoever. So if somebody is even trying to subvert you, that's probably a compliment. This is precisely why I don't think people like Philip Roth at Amran, or whatever his name is, or any of the Jewish speakers, I don't think they're looking to subvert anything. And even when you see Jewish individuals try to join their organizations like NPI or Identity Europa, of course they're going to be rejected. But the very fact that anybody even wants to join you at all is probably symbolic that if they want to subvert you, they're not doing a very good job. Another point that I would make is, why don't we see any Gentiles trying to subvert Jewish movements? I mean,
Luke Ford is an example of that. I don't know how much he succeeded, but
yeah,
possibly he's like, doing that.
If we saw more Gentiles trying to, you know, get into Hollywood, get into media, that would be a much more winning strategy than complaining about the two or three Jewish psychologists who actually bother to show up to Amran to speak. So whenever I see these really anti-Semitic people, I'm not Jewish, but whenever I run into these real tough guys who, you know, they'll make comments directed at me, you know, implying so-and-so and such, I really have to laugh at that, because I think there's a disconnect between how powerful they actually are and how powerful they think they are.
We are at the end of the show. Do you have any last words to kind of tie all these topics together?
I think it would be interesting if we could make good movies, but we also have to come out of a context, and the context we are living in isn't one of tradition, and it isn't one of the alt-right. So, you know, I'm down with degenerate movies. Let's put it like that.
Yeah, stay tuned to watching The Journey to Vapor Island on film in 25 years. That's all I got to say.
Oh, oy vey.
Well, Count Fosco, it's been an excellent show. Thanks for being on.
Right. Thank you, Robert. It's always good talking to you.